Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
If you're new to the First Degree, a word of warning.
When we started the First Degree, we were amateur podcasters, so apologies for any sound issues.
They're really compelling stories, but the sound definitely gets better around episode 15.
So with that being said, turn down your lights.
Turn up that anxiety.
Because this could happen to you.
The First Degree.
First Degree.
First Degree.
First Degree.
First Degree.
First Degree.
The First Degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
Hi, guys, and welcome to The First Degree. I'm Jack Vanek. I'm sitting across from Alexis Linkletter and Billy Jensen, who are true crime professionals, and I have a question.
We have answers.
If our podcast becomes an overnight success, am I also a true crime professional?
Yes.
This is the loophole of like how I get
say,
in.
I would say yes.
Billy's just kind of looking at me.
No. You're a professional if we're making money off of it. You're a professional.
But you can make money off of a lot of things that I would not consider somebody a professional.
Billy's words say yes, but his eyes say
his face is like, I've been doing this for two decades.
We're supposed to be a theater of the mind here. So.
Whatever. That's my goal in life. Okay. So if you guys have not listened to The First Degree before, we're not your average true crime podcast. We are telling stories of murder, crime, and other beyond belief type of situations through the first person perspective or somebody that is 1 degree away from these crimes. We're flipping even the most infamous crimes on their heads and giving you a brand new perspective. And our story today, one of us is the person that's 1 degree away. And we're not going to tell you yet.
No, you'll have to see. But we will tell you that this story will make you question everything you think you know about the people who are close to you. Because you can know someone since grade school, you can live under the same roof as them, sleep in the same bed with them, and have no idea who they really are or what they're capable of. And hopefully you can all learn something from this one, because these people can be all around you.
Yeah, and it's also proof that the American dream isn't always what it seems to be.
That's true.
That's scary.
Now, where's today's case set?
So today's case is in Neskonset, New York. Now, I grew up in Westbury, New York, out on Long Island. When I needed to purchase a home and I was starting my family, I couldn't afford anything in Nassau County. I had to go out to Suffolk County and wanted to push out more and more, further out into Suffolk County. And I found this wonderful little town called Neskonset. And it is really just like a beautiful, affluent Suffolk County suburb. It's got middle class, it's got upper class, and it even has, you know, some couple million dollar houses. So when I was there and I was working a few jobs. I was at the Village Voice. I was covering Long Island crime stories for the New York Times. And the New York Times would call me up on Saturdays and Sundays because they were always shorthanded. And I would answer the phone and they would say, we got something for you. And I'd say, where it is? And they'd say, Hicksville. There was a body found in a barrel underneath a house. And I'd say, okay, I'll be there in 20 minutes. I'd go out. I'd interview the people. I would come back and find a payphone because this is – spoiler alert, this was before anybody really had cell phones.
And then you would call
into what was called Rewrite. Now, if you would look at the New York Times back then, you would see the same reporter did a story on the North Fork of Long Island, in Hackensack, New Jersey, and up in Connecticut. And you're like, how the hell did this guy get to all these different places? He didn't. There were hacks like me that were going around doing the reporting, and then they would call into a Rewrite, and then this one guy, and it was a Pulitzer Prize winner named Bob McFadden. He was the main guy. He would write all of them down. So I got sent out to do a stolen monkey from a pet store in the South Shore.
And damn it, this should have been the case of the week.
Yeah, and I found, you know, and it was A, going from the Village Voice to going to the New York Times is great because people actually would invite you in and offer you coffee and things. It was amazing being able to see you from the New York
Fancy.
Times. But, you know, it was – I was – out there talking to the people who were, you know, finding I found the woman who actually took the monkey within, you know, about 2 hours of working that story. So it was very just flying on the seat of your pants, very different from the stuff that I even do now, which is more featured type reporting. So that's what I was doing. And I was able to earn enough money doing that and working at the Village Voice that I purchased my first home in Neskonset.
One little tidbit about Suffolk County. I don't know, people who like politics. Bob Mercer of Renaissance, you said people with $2 million homes. There are billionaires who live in Suffolk County.
Really?
So this, oh, yeah. So Bob Mercer, who is part of this whole Facebook leak thing that's happening right now.
Right.
He's one of the richest guys in the world. He has a house in Suffolk County. He, in fact, had a fundraiser for Donald Trump. When I was looking up Suffolk County for this story, of course, I
sounds
found
great.
That. You know, just a few minutes from this story where
yeah.
it took place.
So the yeah, and also you've got, and it's not just the people that are out there on the in the Hamptons. Obviously, you have Billy Joel has a house out there, and Howard
right.
Stern, and all those people. So. Mm-hmm. So this was my American dream. I had bought my first home for $131,000 in Neskonset,
oh,
and this
gosh.
Was my, I know, and it was, this was my castle, and I was building a family and building a home there and all that. So in December of 2007, the police responded to a very concerning 911 call that brought them to this home on this quaint street called Alexander Avenue. And this house was actually only 4 minutes from my house. Really very close. And the house looks like a farmhouse. It's completely whitewashed. It's got this big front porch with a big backyard. It's very much the kind of place that you would see and say, wow, I would love to be sipping lemonade on that house in a rocking chair. You know, it's very much the Cracker Barrel-esque, if anybody has Cracker Barrels near them, of
they
like, you know
are.
What? Yeah, Cracker Barrel-esque, like this is where I want to be on a Sunday afternoon.
Right.
And the home was it was a single story residence, but it had a big finished basement.
And as far as the people who lived there, the house belonged to a woman named Martha Watson. She was a 70-year-old grandmother, and she'd been a long-time Neskonset resident. She's a beloved grandmother, and a bunch of her neighbors actually considered her to be a surrogate grandmother to all of the neighborhood children. And Martha, you know, she was older, but she had a job. She worked part-time at the Smith Haven Mall, which was right down the street from her house. The other inhabitant of the home was Martha's 20-year-old grandson. His name was Matthew Watson. And he had lived with his grandmother for 14 years through most of his grade school. And the two were extremely close. And he graduated from Smithtown High School 2 years earlier, so in 2005. He was kind of having a difficult time finding his trajectory in life. He didn't really know what he was doing, no direction. Played a lot of video games.
He didn't have an actual job, right?
No, not really. And then he hung out with the same people he did all through high school. He just hadn't branched out or really done much. And many of the states in the United States are grappling with an opioid epidemic, and he dabbled in that as well. So he was just trying to figure his life out.
Right. So there's this 911 call that happens, and when the police walk into the house, it is beyond comprehension. It's like an actual nightmare. There's splashes of white paint everywhere, blood everywhere, all over the walls, the floor, the ceiling, the furniture. It's just covered in paint and blood, which is a very strange combination.
Very weird.
I'm sure they had no idea what was going on. There was blood on the deck, so the outside deck of the house, trailing from the house and into the yard, footprints and blood everywhere, revealing a path of where the person that was responsible for the carnage was walking around. So the police followed these footsteps into the living room, and of course it led them to a body.
So the police walk into the living room, and they see a deceased person up against a table, an end table, against the north wall. And they're face up with their head between the end table and the wall. And over their face, there's a placemat.
That's weird. What does that suggest to you guys?
It doesn't automatically suggest, I know where you're going with
that,
he knew the person.
Yeah.
And he didn't want the person looking at them in death. So he's not in a bedroom, because usually a lot of times this happens in a bedroom. So they'll throw a sheet over it or a pillow over
yeah.
or something like that. But, you know, closest thing to him was a placemat. I've definitely seen cases. I've definitely been involved with cases where people just don't like having dead people's faces there, and then they'll put something over them.
So,
and they're not related to them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Could it also just be probably that somebody that obviously hasn't killed a person before, and it's shocking, and they just don't want to see something like that? Or is there like a psychology behind it that a lot of times it's done from somebody that's close to the victim?
I think there's both, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think you have no idea what you're going to do in that situation until it happens.
Right.
And if you're there just trying to, if you've just gone in a fit of rage and this is the first time that you've killed somebody and you're sitting there, and then every time that you're trying to pick up all of your pieces, there's a person that's looking at you, yeah. looking at you in death, giving you that literal death stare.
Right.
You know, you might just want to say, I just don't want to see that anymore, and then put something on top of it.
Right.
So, you know, was it more of an amateur move than a professional move? Sure, you would say it was an amateur move.
Yeah. yeah.
Well, the placemat didn't stop the police from identifying the victim.
Yeah, shocking.
And they were able to quickly determine that it was 70-year-old Martha Watson.
Neighbors rattled by the murder of a 70-year-old grandmother. Martha Watson was repeatedly stabbed inside her Nesconset home.
We didn't know what happened at first. And it scared me, you know, because it's right across the street.
I don't know what's happening in there. You know, there's a lot of young children in the neighborhood. It's a little scary.
Who would want to hurt a grandmother?
What could she have possibly done to deserve such a
brutal
death?
Yeah. And apparently, I got the police reports, and we've all been looking through them, but it was clear that this was overkill. And I don't know. I mean, she's living with her troubled grandson. Who would want to hurt an old woman?
Right.
Who's just working at a mall, and the neighborhood matriarch. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But
well, and I feel like from all the interviews that I had read online from people mm-hmm. that knew her, like, everybody loved her. She had no known enemy. So whatever this crime was, obviously did not seem to be directed at her.
No, you'd think not, unless it was a total random
murder
attack.
Yeah.
But so Martha suffered bruising on her right arm, puncture marks on her upper leg and abdomen, puncture wounds on her neck and throat. And she was wearing a gold necklace with a cross and a heart medallion. A yellow ring was found caught in the bathrobe she was wearing, and a gold ring was also caught in her hair. And I guess these rings had fallen off of her when she was being moved by the coroners. And there was also a broken light bulb underneath her shirt, under her back. What does that mean? Maybe in a struggle, a lamp fell over and the bulb
and she fell on top of it.
Yeah, something, but I thought that was odd.
So then the police is going through the home, and every room just gets darker and more horrific, which is absolutely terrifying. The basement, when they went in, had white paint and bloody handprints all over the walls, all over the counter of the basement.
There was an open paint can on the counter in the basement.
Okay, so this is obviously where all the paint is coming from. What do you think cops think when they're walking into a situation like that? What is the first thing on their mind? Why is there paint involved?
I don't know. And I think my instinct would be that this person is trying to conceal fingerprints, maybe with paint, or trying to thinks that there's some chemical that would remove DNA. I don't know. I can't speculate.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like a clear thought.
I mean, if they're going in, and have we determined yet whether she was sexually assaulted or not?
No, she wasn't.
Yeah. After that, my first thought would be that this was not an organized killer. This is somebody that just went in there, and maybe they thought after their fit of rage to try and cover something up. And what's messier than blood? It's paint. And coincidentally, my family business is house painting. So I'm a house painter, and I was a house painter. My father was a house painter, and I was a house painter all throughout, you know, summers in high school and everything like that. So that's another connection.
Was it you?
Could this paint have come from your...
No. Was it Benjamin Moore? Because that's the only paint that I would use. So
that would be
the first thing.
Quite a connection. Wait, did they discover if the paint, was it mixed in with the blood? Was it you know what I mean?
In conjunction with.
Okay. So it's just all mixed. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a nightmare.
Yeah.
So I guess for this part of town, this is completely unthinkable. I'm sure it's just like any other affluent town. In my town growing up, the biggest crime ever was maybe that somebody stole a ball from your garage or something.
Yeah, no. And I'm sure the police did not know what to think, especially suburban cops don't deal with this kind of thing regularly. So I'm sure it was very perplexing.
Right.
Suffolk definitely has pockets of badness. I mean, that's a lot of the MS-13 troubles that are going on right now on Long Island are happening in Suffolk. So it wasn't all white picket fences out in Suffolk, but certainly in this area, they hadn't seen something like this for a while.
Right.
This was also, if anybody that remembers any, you know, true crime stories from Long Island, this is where the Suffolk County Sniper was doing a lot of his work around this area in the 347 corridor. The Suffolk County Sniper was a guy that was trying to win the love of a stripper and thought he would kill all the people around the stripper in order to set up this idea that there was a serial killer in order to get the stripper. It's convoluted. Whoa. It's weird. He didn't really do it, but unfortunately, he shot somebody at the Burger King on 347 from across the street. But there's one other thing that we haven't been telling you. The police have gotten in there, and Martha was not the only victim on that day in December. There was someone else who suffered some pretty substantial injuries during that brutal and just, frankly, bizarre attack. And that was the person who called 911, because it was a male's voice, his name on 911. And that's Martha's grandson, Matthew.
Police say it was around 2 Saturday afternoon when they got a desperate 911 call from Martha's 20-year-old grandson, Matt Watson. Matt apparently didn't know that his grandmother had been attacked in another room when he called police for help.
The caller stated that he had been stabbed by an intruder. When police arrived, they discovered 70-year-old Martha Watson dead from stab wounds. His injuries were severe. He wasn't in a position to observe his grandmother. There are a number of things involved in this case that we don't know, and we're continuing the investigation.
Police believe this is not a random crime, but that is little comfort to people who live in the area.
A full 48 hours after this murder inside of this home on Alexander Avenue, crime tape remains up, detectives looking for clues. Police have also set up a mobile command post, hoping that someone knows something about what happened.
What we do know from court records is that Matt Watson had been arrested earlier this year for heroin possession. And Detective Lieutenant Jack Fitzpatrick says drugs were an issue when referring to the home.
Now, Matthew was barely conscious when he was rushed to the hospital. And he had a lot of injuries, really horrific injuries all over his body. But the most glaring injury was a stab wound to the eye.
Ugh.
And police had no idea to make of it, but they hoped he could come out of his unconscious state and be able to shed some light on it, of all the mayhem that had transpired that day, because they have a guy with injuries all over his body with a stab wound to the eye. They have his grandmother on the ground dead. Certainly they weren't thinking the grandma did this and this was a fight to the death and somebody survived. That wasn't what was going on.
But who knows? I mean, at this point, maybe these injuries are self-inflicted. Maybe it was a fight between them. They don't really know at this point.
I mean, everything was just a disaster.
He's rushed to the hospital, and luckily for the police, Matthew did recover. He came back from the brink of death and he recounted the story of that day. The evening before was November 30th, 2007, and Matt's girlfriend, her name's Diana Mexdorf, had come over that evening. They spent some time together. They took a nap. And then a couple hours later, they woke up. She left around 11 p.m. Matt then stayed up and played video games until 3 or 4 a.m., which must be nice. I haven't been up till 4 a.m.
Yeah, God knows how long. Be nice.
Anyways, so he wakes up around 1 p.m., and he says that he got out of bed. He was groggy. He peeled himself out of bed. And as he was walking to the bathroom, he spotted a figure out of the corner of his eye. And then this person charged at him with a butcher knife. Terrifying. The assailant stabbed Matthew in the face, got him with a knife in the right eye.
Wait, so he stabbed him the first time in the eye?
Yeah. Matthew put his hands up over his face to defend himself, as we all would, and the attacker kept swinging. He was bleeding profusely and was in terrible pain, but the adrenaline kicked in, and he managed to get the knife away from the assailant and fled upstairs to the portion of the house, because Matthew lives in the basement, remember?
Right.
And as Matt runs up the stairs, the assailant takes the can of paint and douses him with it. Odd. Once Matt reaches the upstairs portion of the home, he slammed the door behind him and tried to lock it. But the assailant reached the door right before he could lock it and pushed on it hard, which caused Matthew to slip on the paint and fall to the ground. And then his attacker climbed on top of him and stabbed him several more times as Matthew begged for his life.
So then something happens that I think we've all thought about, especially anybody that's ever listened to a true crime podcast or watched a true crime show, but anybody that's ever watched any movie ever has thought about this. Which is the decision that Matthew has to make that's coming up. So back to the attack, he's calling out for his grandmother, and his attacker actually responds very coldly, "Your grandmother isn't home." And Matthew screams out, "Why are you doing this?" And his attacker doesn't say anything. He starts feeling weak from the loss of blood. He feels defeated. He thinks about giving up. And he's got to make a choice now. Do I keep fighting or do I pretend to be dead? And I think this is a choice that we've all thought about if we were in this situation.
Right.
When would we do that? When would we pretend to be dead? Every war movie, you see it all the time. Mm-hmm. Hoping the attacker would stop stabbing him if he had thought he had finished the job. And obviously, he was already pretty messed up.
Right.
So he thought, you know, let me give this a shot.
How often does, I mean, I don't know how, if we know the answer to this, but does that work?
It definitely works. On Crime Watch Daily, we've done two or three where people have pretended to be dead. And they've been able to wait it out as their assailant goes through the house and then runs away.
I guess it depends on what kind of crime it is, too. Like if it's some kind of a serial murder or whatever, their goal is to kill, and they probably will make sure that they have killed. Whereas in this situation, this is a senseless kind of act, and the person was obviously looking for something in the house. Mm-hmm.
It can be all different types. I think there's a couple of instances of serial killers where somebody has pretended to be dead from a serial killer. Because a lot of times a serial killer, okay, I got that done. Now let me go do something else.
Right. It's not like they're checking for
Yeah, exactly. This isn't ER. They're not necessarily going to be checking for all that kind of stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But there's always the chance that if you do pretend,
the person
potentially will go overkill. And that was a big, considering what he was in and the condition that he was in and what his grandmother was in. And there's this guy that's chucking pain around.
Right.
It could happen that this, you know, so this was a real risk that he was taking.
Right.
I mean, talking about this is the ultimate gamble for your life.
Yeah. Especially what he did to his grandma. It was complete overkill with a grandma.
Well, I don't think he knew that yet.
No, I'm just, well,
oh, yeah.
Just the situation in itself.
Right,
like,
right.
Obviously, that was how the attacker was just going all over the place.
Totally.
So, obviously, that worked because the attacker thought that he killed him, and the assailant got off slowly, looked around, and walked down the stairs. So, that's when Matt saw the opportunity to save himself. He used the last bit of his energy, sprung to his feet, locked the door to the basement, and called 911. So when he was on the phone with the 911 dispatcher, he could hear the guy that was in the house banging and trying to make his way through the door. Ugh. But thank God he didn't. And when the attacker realized that he was on the phone with the police, he ran away.
That is so terrifying, just imagining the banging on the door.
Yeah, and he could get in and he would just be cornered again.
Oh my gosh.
So the story is about to get worse. Because the person that attacked Matthew and attacked his grandmother wasn't a stranger. It was somebody that not only he knew, but it was somebody that he was friends with since the fifth grade. And his name was Victor Chunga.
Did it say in any of the police reports if he realized it was Chunga from the moment that he saw him, correct?
He was stabbed in the eye first. So I think there was a lot of blood. I think throughout the course of the attack, it dawned on him because as he described it in his account in the police report, a slender Latino man, and then he started to hear his voice and then he started to recognize him.
Right, put the pieces together.
Yeah, and I was reading the reports. Chunga had been at his house a few months ago. They both knew him really well since fifth grade. He'd been coming over a lot. So I'm sure the realization was pretty horrifying.
I mean, imagine putting that in your head again, just sort of, you know, somebody from a grade school friend, somebody that you've hung out with, that you continue to hang out with, and all of a sudden they're stabbing you in the eye.
Mm-hmm. It's straight out of a movie. It's like it's somebody turned into a zombie, basically. That's insane.
It's terrible.
On this season of Cold Case Files, we'll close the book on the Golden State Killer, a serial killer so prolific, investigators spent years thinking he was three different people.
I think this offender is the most brazen in American history.
We'll find cryptic clues on business cards, diaries, and tombstones.
This defendant left his calling card at the scene of the crime.
Get new episodes of Cold Case Files every Tuesday on Podcast One and your favorite podcast app.
Obviously, Matt knew Chunga.
Right.
Billy grew up in the same...
Well, I grew up in Westbury, but I lived in Wisconsin.
The same town.
In the same town. I lived in that town. And, you know, this is where I was doing all my crime stories. But, and, you know, he lived, you know, really close to my house. This horrific thing happened really close to my house. But this isn't my story. There's someone else in this room who this story is one degree from. And it's not me.
It's me. It's my story.
Congratulations.
Alexis, congratulations. So, yeah, unfortunately, Chunga had been one of my best friends growing up. And this was a total shock. We had been friends since ninth grade, and he was this fabulous, flamboyant gay guy. And we would all have sleepovers with him, all the girls and him, and all of our moms were fine with it because it was pretty clear that
he wasn't trying to get it on with you.
Exactly. And we were all just really close. Sweet 16s are really big on the East Coast. They're not so big in LA, but they're very big on the East Coast. And I had a Sweet 16, and they have this ceremony, the candle lighting ceremony, and you give one out of 16 candles to people close to you. And him, I gave him and my other friend Charisse a candle at my party. So they go up and they light a candle, and then you give them kind of a speech about why they're so important to you. So that's how good of a friend he was, which is a very good friend. And we stopped being friends probably in 2005. He started to get hooked on drugs. And I feel like one thing that I do want to say, and Billy can corroborate this, is that I feel like a lot of crime podcasts, crime shows, they shy away from crime stories that involve drugs because it's not necessarily a highbrow crime or...
Right.
But I feel like these stories need to be profiled because our country is dealing with an epidemic like we've never seen before in heroin and opioid use.
You know, you brought up the thing about the drugs and how a lot of true crime shows won't even cover stories that have to deal with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
They also, you know, we know, having worked as true crime producers, we know the formula, and it always starts with everything is great. And that's what true crime is. True crime is turning order back from chaos, but it starts with everything is great. If you were telling the story, even within an hour of a regular TV show that's on, that would be on ID or Oxygen or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you want to hear about how he was the fun guy that was at your sleepovers, that you all slept in the same bed together, the Sweet 16 story with the candles, or whatever the hell else you people did out there in Suffolk County when I was in there. So
no, that is so true, though. Nobody is going to have any sort of an attachment to, because it's like they're creating a character, basically.
Exactly.
So and
one of the reasons why they don't do drugs is because it's not relatable, and everybody... What they think is everybody thinks, okay, you know what? That person deserved it because they were doing drugs. But because the opioid epidemic is getting so bad right now that everybody knows somebody that has had a drug issue.
Right.
There's not going to be one person under the age of 50 that doesn't have somebody, not just like, oh, that guy from high school. I'm talking about somebody close to them mm-hmm. that hasn't had an opioid issue.
Yeah, Billy, and you're absolutely right, and we all know how deadly this opioid epidemic has been, and it's been the leading cause of death for individuals under the age of 50 for the last decade now. But let's shift gears really quick and observe the U.S. murder rate. And how does that relate to the opioid epidemic? Well, America saw its murder rate rise for the first time in 10 years in 2015, 2016, and the first half of 2017. And the connection isn't totally obvious at first glance. Drug and opioid overdoses have been increasing for decades. However, what many people don't realize is that the opioid epidemic really started with prescription drugs, with kids rifling through their parents' medicine cabinets. But starting around 2011, opioid painkiller overdose deaths began to level off, and heroin overdoses and the use of illicit opioids began to increase. And it's this transition into the illicit market that may have helped cause a rise in murders. Experts are starting to think that the spike in murders is directly related to the opioid epidemic. And illegal drug markets are much more violent than legal drug markets. The greater use of illicit opioids came with much more violence, and that's what we're seeing. I mean, even here in this situation, Matt Watson was dealing. And they're saying a lot of these homicides are related to the illicit drug market for opioid dealers. So that's all I have to say about the correlation between the opioid epidemic and the murder spike. But if you don't believe me, here's some proof of this that I collected from all over the country.
Murders, shootings, and other assaults are on the rise. The opioid epidemic. Drugs, he says, are at the core of most of the city's violent crime, and the reason many cases go unsolved.
New numbers show a sharp increase in the most serious violent crimes. Opioids are behind the increase.
The biggest rise comes in aggravated assaults. Those committed with firearms in 2017 were up 27%. With other dangerous weapons, they were up more than 40%.
If I had to pick one thing, I'd say that the opioid crisis is impacting the crime rates.
Yeah, that's right. This crash right here happened in a St. Louis suburb yesterday. This man charged in the wreck, plowing into a family of three, sending them all to the hospital. Police say at the time, the driver high on heroin. St. Louis seeing a huge increase in heroin and related violence. Law enforcement here says Kansas City is next.
Compared to last year, armed robberies are up 325%. Assaults involving a gun are up 135%. They found that most of it is drug-related and linked to heroin specifically.
Obviously, the opioid epidemic is already the deadliest drug overdose crisis in U.S. history. But the fact that this crisis might also be tied to the first spike in murders in the U.S. for the last decade, and that's beyond alarming. And the butterfly effect of this epidemic is way bigger and more far-reaching than we ever could have imagined. And this correlation can affect crimes in a myriad of ways. And I know, Billy, tell me about some of the serial cases you're working on and how this is all connected.
So, and that's where a lot of the, you know, this story that I'm still working on now in Columbus, Ohio, it's a buffet for serial killers because all these girls are all addicted to drugs and they're all strung out and they have to work no matter how many serial killers are circling the waters there. And they're just like, all right, you know what? The dinner bell's on and I'm able to kill as many people as I want because these girls just keep going out there because they need the money for drugs.
Right.
So that's what you're seeing within true crime, and hopefully it will become relatable at some point.
I'm not sure this is relatable to everyone else, but since I'm 1 degree away from one of these stories, I certainly find it relatable. So let's get back into this Chunga thing, shall we? So my friendship with Chunga really started to taper off and end when he started to dabble in heroin and dabble in his drug use. And then in 2005, I moved to LA, and this happened in 2007, so 2 years later.
So what kind of a person was he when you knew him? Obviously, drugs can turn somebody into something completely differently, but what was his?
So it's really interesting. He was, at the time, I thought he was sweet, but looking back, there was something off. He was really mean, not to you if he was your friend, but really mean. He would make up rumors about you. A lot of stealing. I got in trouble for stealing when I was like 13.
Everybody
but this
did.
Was older and almost compulsive from department stores, bringing like pliers to pull off security tags off expensive, like dangerous stealing that could actually get you in trouble. He made up a pretty terrible rumor about me in ninth grade, but I could never prove that it was him, but I was told it was him. But yeah, he was allegedly one of my best friends, but you put up with that kind of stuff in high school.
Yeah, when you're younger.
In Smithtown High School, where I went, people are particularly mean. I don't know. I couldn't tell you in one sitting all the horrible things that bullies did to me. But he was mean.
He was so sweet, but he was mean.
I love that's. It's really conflicting because it was very, in retrospect, it's a little sociopathic, some of the stuff that he would do. What I want to say, too, is that looking back on this, there were things about him that are so confusing, because I remember his brother had a baby, still has a baby, but now, you know, she's much older, but he loved his niece, obsessed with babies, wanted to be a math teacher. He was truly two people, because then he would do really kind, amazing things for you. So I don't want to take away from his redeemable qualities, but clearly the dark side won here. I'm still very conflicted, and I've done a million shows on murder, and part of my job is I find the interesting stories that I want to make shows about or episodes about or podcasts about, and then generally you reach out to the people to see if they're willing to talk to you and be involved in whatever show you're trying to put together. And in this situation, when it was a story involving people I knew, I wasn't able to do it. I have all these people as friends on Facebook, and I wanted to reach out to them to see if they would talk to me about this episode. And it was too weird and too hard. This got very real for me really fast. That's the really weird thing about being 1 degree away from these situations. There's no longer a divide between you and the monster or you and the monstrous act. It is very surreal. You know these people while they're still human, before they become monsters, before a new narrative is chosen for them. And in this story, there's a new narrative for Matt. There's a new narrative for Martha Watson. There's a new narrative for Chunga. Monster, victim. These evil people are multifaceted, and so are good people. And it just makes you really get introspective and examine and take stock of your relationships and the people you know, which is the point of this podcast.
I have a question about, this is not directly related to what we're just talking about, but when we're talking about people not covering the drug mm-hmm. cases, do you guys think, obviously he had some darkness in him. You never are going to think that somebody is capable of murder. That is just so incomprehensible to a normal everyday person. So do you think that a drug like heroin could turn anybody into becoming that type of a monster, or does it take some sort of a maybe a bit sociopathic?
I think it exacerbated something that was already there.
Yeah,
because he was very devious but likable. I don't know how to explain it, where if it wasn't focused at you, it was funny. And at high school, you don't have the capacity to look deeper into a behavior. Wow, that is really, you're a sociopath if you can do XYZ. I didn't have the ability to do that at that point, but I do now. And when I talk to my friends about this, we all now say, I guess in retrospect, I can see it happening.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into this. Matthew Watson was dabbling in heroin himself, and it had been rumored to be dealing. And obviously Chunga, in some state of withdrawal or state of hyper-focus on getting heroin, decided to break into Matt's house, his friend.
Because he wasn't, like, high at the time of the murder, right?
Well, I read his confession, and he says he wasn't. He said he had used the night before,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry that this happened to Matt, and I'm sure he has to live with this every day, but he lured this person into his grandmother's house. And his grandmother, I think he has familial problems, which is why his grandma stepped in as the primary caretaker. But this woman was kind enough to house him for 14 years, and he opened this window for this kind of crime to happen.
It's probably not the right place to be dealing drugs if you're living with your grandma.
Right. And again, these are 20-year-olds. Your brain isn't fully developed till you're 26, I understand. But Matthew still has his life. And I knew Matt in high school, but not well. We never talked, but we were all kind of in the same general circle. So I don't know him, and I'm sure he's a nice person, but I feel terribly for his grandmother.
Right.
So basically what's happened since with Chunga, I kind of follow this. He was given 35 years to life.
I have a question. So did they just, they knew immediately it was him, right? When they talked to Matthew.
Right. After they found out it was him, they went to his parents' house, and they had learned that on the day of the murder, Chunga had stolen, we all call him Chunga, by the way. We never called him Victor, but he'd stolen his dad's car and was gone for a few hours and came back covered in paint and had said he had been beaten up by some kids, which is odd. But his parents were really pissed, and I'm sure his parents knew that he was dealing with some sort of addiction. But yeah, he kind of tried to resume his life, and a few days later, the cops picked him up outside of a convenience store at a nearby strip mall.
Right.
And he confessed pretty quickly. He was sentenced to 35 years to life, and there's been no updates media-wise, except I was able to find that there's this program for inmates, a writing program or a writing contest, and he won some honorable mention for a memoir he wrote called In My Own Time.
About the murder?
I have no idea. All of them were available. You could click on it and read it, and not his. And I was just like, damn it. But he's written letters to Rita, who Jack knows is a friend of mine. He's written letters to a number of the people involved in this story. Yeah, and I guess he sent Rita a Facebook message. We're not sure where he got Facebook access, which is super odd. But
don't some inmates have Facebook and then, like, internet access?
They're not supposed to.
But they somehow do.
Yeah. I mean, there was actually big issues in some of the southern states, and they were trying to make it a bigger violation if they went on Facebook.
How do you even get on Facebook?
There's going to be computers there. You know? Obviously, there's computers in every jail, and it's just a matter of just slipping the guard a few bucks or doing something.
I do want to talk about something really odd that happened in the weeks leading up to the murder that I didn't know until I got these police documents.
Yeah.
And it involves Chunga's best friend at the time, Charisse. So Charisse, obviously the other girl I gave a candle to at my Sweet 16, was a friend of mine. And she, I guess, one night went to work. She was, I think, bartending or working at night at the time. And her dad, when she got home, said, I think someone tried to break into your room. And they looked around and they couldn't really find any signs of that. But that's what he thought he heard. And then a few days later, the dad hears something again, and they see a ladder up against the home to Charisse's window. And they go around and look outside, and they find a set of keys. And the dad shows them to Charisse, and she recognizes them as being her best friend's keys. So she's fuming. She also notices money's missing from her room. And this is her best friend.
So he climbed up to her room, stole some of her shit.
Stole money from his best friend.
And this is right before this happened.
Yeah. And she decides to wait a couple days. And this is per her written account in the police documents. I'm not making this up. Then she calls him and confronts him. He starts crying and asks her to meet him in front of his house. She does. And she confronts him further, and he starts crying and sobbing, saying he has cancer and that no one, including his family, will help him pay for treatment, which why he was forced to steal. Now, this isn't true. Chunga
this is complete actual bullshit.
Actual bullshit. And it just shows, I don't know if it's desperation. I don't know if his withdrawal was that crazy, but like he was doing these wild things. And Chunga, I have his confession in front of me, and he basically lays out he wanted fine drugs. He broke into the house. He saw Martha in the house. She says, "What are you doing here?" He says, "I got in through that door," points to a door. "I have a key." She's using a walker.
Wait, he had a key to Matt's house?
He lied. And she didn't believe him, and she starts getting really loud. Then he pushes her and tries to throw a blanket on her, and she continues to scream. He sees a knife on the table, and that's when this whole thing starts. And I don't know at what point he decided to do this, or
I know. I wonder if there wasn't a knife on the table, if it was just a very situational thing.
I don't know, but the really sad thing is, and it even hurts me to say this, but she wasn't supposed to be home that day. She was supposed to be at her job at the mall, but she just had knee surgery, and she was recovering, and she had all these pins in her knee. It's really awful.
It's awful. It's like wrong place, wrong time.
Exactly. So he says this. I can't hear his voice in this confession, but he's very matter of fact. And he knew the moment she was dead, and he still decided to go downstairs and, with a knife, confront his friends in fifth grade. So I can't speculate as to mind frame. You two are welcome to, but this is beyond me.
Well, obviously the first mind frame is, what was his motivation? He was trying to get drugs. And you either go and try to get money, you try to get drugs. He knew or thought he knew that there were drugs in the house, and he was going to do everything he could because he was addicted in order to get the drugs. The next question is, and as sane, rational people who are not addicted to drugs, we're thinking, well, why wouldn't you just tie up the grandma or punch the grandma? You know, why would you actually go and kill the grandma? But we can't put ourselves in that position because we have no idea what those chemicals are doing in his body and what his frame of mind is.
Right.
The one thing I will say that I think is really interesting is that there seems to be a familiarity component here where the people he targeted his best friend.
Yeah, it's everybody that he knows.
Yeah, it would strike me as someone would want to do the opposite of that. Why would you?
Does he have no remorse for what he's doing? Does he feel no guilt for what he's doing? That's a whole nother thing.
Well, I don't have police documents to support this, but I remember hearing at the time when he was in custody, he went on suicide watch because he had tried to kill himself. And I think with a clear mind now, he wants to, I was reading some reports, speak to prisoners about the dangers of heroin and speak to kids who are getting in trouble. And I think now he's clear-headed and probably can't believe what he did.
Now, you said that you had taken a look at the confession. Do you have it with you?
Yeah.
Can you read a little bit of it?
Very hard to read.
It's very illegible, but this is, he's speaking about the day of, and he said, "I knew that Watson," everyone called him Watson, Matt Watson, "would be home, and his bedroom was downstairs. I walked to the back of the house and removed the screen from the window to Watson's old bedroom. I knew he always kept the window unlocked. I opened the window and went inside, and then I locked the window behind me. When I got to the living room, I saw his grandmother. She was standing right behind me. I saw a walker right next to her. I'm not sure if she was using it. She asked me how I got in. I told her I had to wake Watson up, and I came in through the door that I had a key to. She didn't believe me, and she started getting loud. I pushed her to the floor, and she went down. I got a blanket, and I tried to wrap her in it to keep her quiet. But she resisted and started scratching my hands and face. And I tried to put a towel over her face, but that didn't work either. She was screaming at me, and that's when I saw the knife on the dining room table. I told her to shut up, and I stabbed her in the neck many, many times. She was lying down on the floor when this happened. She was still fighting back when I stabbed more times. I can't remember on what part of her body. I stabbed her everywhere except for her neck. I put a little towel on her face, and she started, I don't know if it says twitching. It's really bad handwriting. And I knew she was dead. I went into the bathroom and washed her blood off of my hands. I then went downstairs because I knew that Watson was there. I grabbed a larger knife from the kitchen and I took it with me. When I went downstairs, I saw a can of white paint and I opened it. I wanted to blind Watson with it so he wouldn't recognize me. His bedroom door was locked and I couldn't get in, so I waited for him to come out. At some point, Watson came out of his room. I hid in the kitchen downstairs because the finished basement had its own kitchen. And he went to the downstairs bathroom. When he came out of the bathroom, I had the knife in my hands. I threw the paint at him, but it didn't get in his eyes. I shoved him and we started a fight. And then I stabbed Watson in the eye area.
Now, you're reading that, obviously, because you were talking about the handwriting and how the handwriting is bad. Is that his handwriting?
Yeah. Yes.
And that sounds like a rational guy with a rational explanation for a horrific act, but he was...
Well, it's just very, very matter-of-fact.
Yeah, like, very matter-of-fact, very much like, all right. And then the questions that we were saying that we would all do as rational people without a drug problem is, oh, you know, why didn't he just smother her or something along those lines? It looks like he tried to.
Right.
She was screaming so much. He's thinking, I need to get the drugs. Matt could come up and find me doing this, and then that's going to prohibit me from getting the drugs, so I'm going to have to stab her. That's what was going through his mind. And then, you know, my question is from reading that is that he wanted to blind Matt. Mm-hmm. Did he want to blind him and then kill him? Or did he want to blind him
and
just so he wouldn't see him and then get the drugs?
You know, and he talks about here at the end of it is the last time I used heroin prior to this incident was the day before. I didn't use any that day, and I wasn't high at the time. My intention was just to steal the drugs at Watson's. But I was seen, and I was scared he'd be able to identify me, so that's why I tried to kill them. And...
Oh my God, it's the most ass-backwards thing.
No, and I talked to Rita about this, my best friend, and we're still sick over it. If you saw us all in a room sitting together, you'd think we were all the same caliber of person. Yeah, they're all from a nice area, nice parents. It just... How do we all turn out so well? Rita's a dentist. I have a cool kind of job. It's like, how do some of us turn out that way and some of us turn out this way? I don't know.
Right.
And I don't, you know.
Have you had a reunion yet? Like an actual reunion?
Yeah. We had our 10-year reunion last summer.
And what was that like?
It was fun.
I can't believe you even went. I didn't even know what happened.
Whatever.
I went to
high school with Alana Glazer from Broad City.
Oh, yeah. I forgot how much you were excited about that.
Oh, come on. She's cool, Jack. And she was our student council president and the valedictorian, and she planned our reunion, and it was fun.
Obviously, Chunga did not go.
Did any of you talk about Chunga at all?
No, but no.
Did Matt go, or was Matt in your class?
He was in my class. I didn't even notice. No, I didn't think about it. I will say, I think I told you this. MySpace was still cool at this time, and I had a million pictures up with him, and people started to send me death threats. Like, take these pictures down. No, I didn't check MySpace anymore.
Right.
So I took them down, but I have them. And we're going to put all these police reports, well, some of the good ones, and I've got a bunch of pictures I can throw up
there,
too.
Yeah, we should put them on our website.
Yeah, so look for those if you want to see them.
Well, I was going to say, when I was looking up Chunga's name and, you know, all these different police reports and articles were coming up, there was one that had turned into a vicious argument of comments.
I saw that one, too.
Yeah, of people being – talking about a bunch of different things from – racism to Matt was a drug user too. He deserves to be in jail. Why did he not get tried? Everybody going back and forth. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There was a lot, and it was...
No, and there's a lot to argue over too.
Right.
I'm sure they feel much differently today than they did then. I mean, a number of years have passed. You can blame heroin, but not everyone who does heroin hurts people. Yeah,
yeah.
So I would not go as far to say that, but I will say heroin lured him there.
Right.
And that's how Martha lost her life, which is terrible.
Yeah.
Did his parents – was he stealing from his parents first? Because usually that's the progression, is that you're going to start stealing from people that are around you. You would go to your parents. You'd start stealing from mom's wallet, et cetera, know where your dad hides
his money.
Yeah,
it's always like a little progression.
And then it would go to maybe the friends, and then it would go to, all right, the drug dealers.
So
his dad made a statement too, right?
Through a translator.
Yeah.
So they were Peruvian. They made a great life for their kids, but – I think beyond the statement, no one really knows. They didn't speak English well. So
yeah.
Presumably, but I don't know. Okay. I feel bad. And I heard, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that
allegedly.
During allegedly, during the court proceedings, he had no support. He did not have
from
family.
Any of his family.
No. Could you? I don't know. I don't know that my parents would support me through something this senseless.
Heinous, yeah.
Yeah.
And I have one last question, I guess, about how, so he obviously confessed, mm-hmm. and so he took a plea deal, correct? Mm-hmm. What?
Well, he pled guilty.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Did he not take a plea deal, though? I mean, did he?
He got 35 to life.
So what? Okay. So
if he confessed right away. It's not like he was playing hardball.
Right.
Because Matt recognized, the jig was kind of up. But I do have I forgot to tell you guys one story about my friend Lisa. So Matt was in the hospital and Lisa goes to visit him, mm-hmm. right? And Matt Watson says it was Chunga to her. And she's best friends with Chunga too. So she's terrified and everyone's in shock. And she goes home and Chunga calls her and was like,
wait, this is before he got caught?
Yeah, before the arrest.
Oh, God.
Chunga didn't know if Matt was still alive or not. And he's like, you went to visit Matt. And Lisa said, yeah. And he's like, well, was he conscious? And Lisa lied and was like, no. And Chunga was like, so he didn't say anything. And Lisa said, no. And Chunga was like, well, I'm going to come over. I want to talk to you about it.
Oh, hell
And Lisa
no.
was like, no. And said that she was busy and not going to be home. But like left with her parents until he was arrested because she said he sounded crazy.
Yeah.
Lisa's one of his best friends. Chunga just murdered a close friend. No one really knew what he was going to do
at
this time.
Yeah, what he was capable of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you do in that situation, too, when you're realizing that your friend just said your other friend tried to kill him? And what do you do? What do you do
and
with
then
that?
Your other
and then your other friend calls you
up with you.
And trying to meet up with you.
That's terrifying.
God. So, yeah, guys, this is my first degree story. And I'm not thrilled about the drug component because I've been programmed not to want to, but I do think these stories need more attention.
They need to be told.
Most of these sensational stories you see on the news or in the media have a drug component that they just don't broadcast it. And I think as far as cautionary tales go, hiding the drug component does not do anyone any favors. People need to know about this. It helps people deter people from drugs and help spot red flags. Help could have stopped this, I think. I don't know.
Right.
What do you guys think?
I don't know. If it wasn't this thing, potentially it could have been something else.
Yeah.
You know? But definitely that's what kicked it into high gear.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the reason why we decided to do this podcast. You know, there's a million podcasts out there. But it's the idea that these are all – every murderer is somebody's friend at some point, and you all have them. Every listener that's listening out there has a story like this, and that's why we want to tell them, because it's such a unique perspective that nobody knows what they would do. It's very easy to be listening to a podcast where you're completely separated from it, or watching a true crime show where you're so separated from the action or the emotions. But if you put yourself right into it, you're going to be conflicted.
Right. So, I mean, I guess we'll sign off on most people are connected to something like this, and we want to hear your stories. So if you guys have a Stranger Than Fiction story that you want us to tell, please email us at hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Follow us on Instagram @thefirstdegree, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, and @JackVanek. And keep your friends close, but not that close.
Thank you for tuning in to The First Degree. Check out new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts.
Recently on The Producer's Guide.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Check out Todd Garner's interviews with Rob Riggle.
Semper Fi is the Marine Corps motto. Semper Gumby should be the producer. Always flexible.
Marlon Wayans.
My dad's not funny. He's really annoying. My mom curses him out, and that's where we found out comedy.
And Eli Roth.
I liked 16 Candles and Ferris Bueller, but I was waiting for the nudity. I hated those movies. I thought it was the death of cinema.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Every Thursday on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Remember to rate and review.